Satisfactory wall. Dreams a dream by the old canal. I shut my wad on sunny winds. Dirty old town. It's a dirty old town. All my balls have not been washed. Eaten hog on a lovely beach. Suck a fuck and eat my butt. Dirty old town. It's a dirty old town. And now I'll send out a text from Twitter saying that I'm streaming on here, typing out on the internet. Dirty old town, dirty old town. Clicking on a little button so I can post myself online, waiting for some folks to show up now. Dirty old town, dirty old town. Okay, hi folks. Can you hear me? Might be a little tinny or compressed, as people like to say. I still don't know what that means, but apparently last time it was compressed. I still don't have a. I'm now streaming on the laptop, but I do not have a dedicated microphone yet. My apologies. Hopefully, you can hear me. So, today we're mostly going to talk about just one chapter from Eric Foner's Reconstruction, Chapter 8. Because we had some technical issues last time, we only going to do one chapter today. Chapter 8, which is about the consolidation of Republican power in the Southern Reconstruction states post-14th Amendment, and what they did, what their political and economic agenda ended up looking like. What does he call it? The chapter is titled Pol Reconstruction Political and, or no, I'm sorry. Yes, Reconstruction Political and Economic. So we're talking about how the political coalition, the power that the Republican Party was able to exercise in the South, exercise that power, how it tried to change the culture of the newly emancipated South and how to change its political economy. So, the governments that took power in the South, the Reconstruction governments, were largely dominated politically by moderates, which is what you would expect because those are the people who are closest to power. People with money tend to be moderate. People who have access to networks of capital and influence tend to be moderate, not radical. And so you had amongst these people carpetbaggers who'd come to the South to speculate and make money in politics or in the market. You had hustling urban Southerners who were not part of the old planter class, and some wealthy free blacks who were also already part of some sort of power structure before the war. They take power in these political parties due to their proximity to power pre-existing, because that's the reality of power. It concentrates at polls, and you have to have a certain relationship to power in order to be able to exercise it. It's one of the fundamental contradictions of democratic governance in a exploitative economic structure. The exploited are by definition kept from real meaningful positions of influence, except for their labor power, which can only be coordinated in its use. Their individual influence is minimal. That's why they're being subject. That's why they're not in charge. So anyway, these moderate Southern Republicans go into power with an idea that they're going to secure their power in the South. This new Republican Party that is in a South that had been totally dominated by the Democrats since the days of Jackson. We're going to do it by bringing in capital investment from the North, and also by reaching out to the common white Southerner who were largely Democrats. So that project of reaching out to white Democrats politically while trying to reach up to Northern capital economically fail in both efforts. And in fact, the failure of one necessitates the failure of the other. But in this case, I would argue that it was the seeking of Northern capital that doomed the project of expanding the electoral appeal of the Republican Party, which we will get into. So, like, for example, in Georgia, the moderate Republicans decided not even to seat the black legislators who had been elected because the Constitution didn't, or their state constitution didn't provide for it. And they went with that, even at the demand of Democrats to try to appeal to them. Didn't get any of them, just alienated the former slaves. But the real thing that undermined the effectiveness of these Reconstruction governments was the quick emergence of factionalism within the Republican parties. And it was not necessarily around race or ideology that formed these conflicts so much as it was the spoils of political patronage. Because due to the economic isolation of Republicans, black and white, in the offices, in public offices, both appointed and elected, the necessity to secure a living through politics becomes much more powerful than it would be among a people who could, if they wanted to, get other work. By working in the Reconstruction government, both white and black politicians had essentially burned their bridges with the merchant community, with respectable white economic structure. They were essentially banned from intercourse with the economy. So they had to secure themselves and their families through politics. And that went for white and black Republican legislators and officials. And so there is this mad scramble for patronage. And it revolves generally, like I said, not around ideology, but around either federal or state jobs. So essentially, you would see conflicts between political organizations led by a Republican governor fighting the political machine of a state's senator. Because these are separate pots of money, and these are separate job groupings and separate connections of vassalage. And so they create separate structures. And they have at their top, for the most part, white people, but they're also have at their base black participation, both with votes and then also with the lower level jobs within the structure. And you see the emergence of black political organization around like churches in the rural areas, community organizations that hooks into these patronage networks. But their power within these structures is undermined by their lack of capital, because they have been dispossessed of the land that they had been exploited for their labor and were now dispossessed of the ability to make a living. They were put out onto the market, but it turns out that if you don't have capital built in, and we mostly have, in a putative democracy, there is a social capital that adheres to everyone regardless of their actual capital. But slaves are ex-slaves are coming into a world as citizens without anything. And at that point, even though the liberal ideology of the time insisted, no one can get anything for anything. Everyone has to work through. That was, of course, all premised on the fact that everybody was basically taking what they wanted from the world, from the bounty of the expropriated Native American held land of the South, of the American continent. Now there's no land to give to these people because, of course, they didn't earn it. And so they are in a condition more abject than an American citizen is supposed to be, which means they need market intervention that is not supposed to happen in a democracy. There was a way to alleviate that, and that is, of course, land redistribution, but that went against the interests of capital and also the ideological infrastructure of liberalism that dominated capitalism's regime. So even while this fighting is happening and this corruption is getting endemic and these machines are starting to fight, they are actually passing legislation. And they are creating for the first time in the South an infrastructure of like a modern welfare state. They're building the first schools and hospitals and asylums and the first sanitation structures, the first penitentiaries. And this is, you know, providing a new dimension of government intervention in the economy, at least as it was understood at the time. This is a step forward, a qualitative step forward in the humanity of the relationship between government and citizen. Because the condition of the ex-slaves undermines the liberal fantasy of what a state is. The idea that it's just something there to structure private intercourse and to provide some sort of framework for people to work things out themselves is undergirded by a fundamental assumption of subsistence, of land access. That there was none of that for the former slaves, and that contradiction had to be resolved. Now, of course, one way to resolve it would have been to make them into landowners, but that would have conflicted with the existing nostrums around private property that had solidified. And also the interests of finance that wanted to see the Southern plantation economy brought back on its feet as soon as possible. But in the absence of land redistribution, what was necessitated by this new contradiction being exposed is an expansion of government's prerogative, which is what they did. And this did contribute to the well-being of people in the South in a way that had never been there before. Education for poor black and white students for the first time. And what I believe a Louisiana legislature, I think it was, had a line that I thought was very apropos, that Foner quotes, speaking of the former slaves, they look to the law because in the very nature of things, they can't look nowhere. They can look nowhere else. They can't. They look to the law because in the very nature of things, they can look nowhere else. As in, there is no land for them to fall back on to try to exist outside of a social structure and a wage relationship. They are forced into social intercourse with all local systems arrayed against them by racial classification and by their status as uncapitalized. And it's only the law that can protect them. So there's four things that Foner points out that dominate the agenda of these Reconstruction governments. Structuring an education system, regulating race relationships, regulating labor relationships, and pursuing economic development. So when it comes to education, for the most part, the Reconstruction governments were sort of happy to allow for segregated education to be enforced as the path of least resistance to public provision. Because this was going to be the first time many of these states had any public education. A lot of people were able, even the ex-slaves said, fine, whatever, let's just get some education. Especially since black-only schools were more likely to be influenced, were more likely to hire black teachers and to be responsive to the concerns of black parents. So there was a willingness to go with that. Although there was some where there was a concentrated black power, either in the form of black wealth in New Orleans, where they were able to integrate a school system that persisted even in the face of white flight to private academies, which after a few years was reversed and black white students returned to integrated public schooling, or in South Carolina, which was, as it was the most radical conservative reactionary state in the lead up to the Civil War and was the state where secession began, because it was the most thoroughly planterized country, state. The largest percentage of the population was black. Planters had the most hegemonic control of the political institutions and the culture. Now, because of that, the fact that so many of the citizens in South Carolina were black and black enfranchisement was the law, South Carolina is one of the most radical Reconstruction states for the same reason, or it is the most radical Reconstruction state. And when they attempted to integrate the University of South Carolina, and there was a mass walkout of white students and faculty, they brought in northern faculty, they abolished tuition, they created preparatory classes to help people get to the minimum standard, and created a integrated public institution of education. And when it came to the question of race relations in the public, which was the second area that they had to address, there was a significant and successful drive to maintain or impose integration of public accommodations in the form of things like streetcars. Beyond that, there was no real effort to enforce a integrationist agenda, once again, as a path of least resistance. On the question of labor relationships, these Reconstruction governments made it their business. They were very insistent upon reordering the negotiating position in favor of agricultural laborers who could, so that they could dictate the terms of their own labor in the face of the presidential Reconstruction era, when it was an attempt, which was an attempt by the planters to use, essentially to take private regimes of slave compulsion and make them public. Instead of that, Reconstruction governments outlawed corporal punishment, narrowed the vagrancy laws to reduce the number of people who could be arrested just for not being employed, resisted demands by plant owners to enclose land from foraging of livestock, prioritized the workers' claim on the crop of a given plantation ahead of any debtors or debt holders who might be owed money by the planter, so that you wouldn't have a situation which often happened where it is a debt-drowning planter will get a raise a crop out of the field on the promise he's going to split it with his workers, then his creditors will come in and take the majority or even all of the profit, giving them the workers no wage for having labored. And they banned that practice and made the workers' claims on the cotton the first to be settled in any kind of a delinquency issue. And then as an extension to the poor whites who were part of this coalition, there was debt relief, which didn't affect ex-slaves very much because they didn't have any debt, because they didn't have any, because they were slaves. Any debt was held by their owners. So, but they wanted to create this coalition, so they supported debt relief for the poor whites. But the big, almost universal fuck up and failure, and you could say, you can't blame them really, because we'll talk about how this is determined by other forces. Every one of these, except once again with the partial exception of South Carolina, every one of these reconstructed southern state governments failed to redistribute land in any significant way. And of course, South Carolina, they were able to do it because, once again, black political power was most concentrated. So There was no confiscation of land from rebels, which honestly would have had to have been the purview of the federal government anyway. So there was some efforts to sell land, but once again, you don't have any debt if you're an ex-slave, but that means you don't have any assets either. And that includes the bare capital necessary to improve a piece of land, because all these Homestead Act things stipulate that the land must be improved, which means you have to have the capital assets necessary to improve land. The hoe, the hammer, the tools, the literal tools, in order to do it. And if they're planting crops, they need the seed and things like that. They need the fodder. And former slaves didn't have this. And this required this dilemma where you have this land, and it's not a very, it's a sparsely settled part of the world. So even absent massive land confiscation, there was land to be given, but it could not be sold because they had had their labor power taken from them completely for their entire lives. In order to overcome this conflict, this contradiction, where they needed to redistribute land, but they could only do it through a mechanism of commerce that former slaves could not enter into, was to transcend the contract notion, was to transcend the presiding ideological structure in the service of justice. Because land, in this turning land into the personification of justice, not the ability to enter into contract, but the actual land that was worked with one's life. And I would say that, well, it's hard to imagine that happening given the structure, the ideological strictures, not just about things like property, but about race that bound the people we're talking about here. I think that that there was room for that notion to kindle, but in the context where land redistribution had in fact been stamped out and reversed, instead of being allowed to fructate, there simply was not enough pressure on the existing system within the southern states, in Washington, anywhere, to demand that justice. And instead, and there was an attempt to do that in the face of the insufficiency of the Reconstruction governments to provide land justice, there were in several southern states labor conventions of ex-slaves coming together to try to agree upon a black laborer's agenda for the governments that they were supporting. And they wanted, and this was a political expression of that cry for justice. It's the closest thing we have, or they had that they could articulate. And what they articulated was minimum dignified wage for agricultural labor and land redistribution. And in the face of that, the Reconstruction governments, which, as I said, are professionalized, are pulled away from the grassroots of former slave voters who get them in there, are kind of captured in these webs of patronage and corruption, and the need for Yankee money, let's not undermine that, couldn't give land. They didn't feel they could, they didn't want to. And what they did instead was they said, look, how about instead of addressing this injustice, everybody gets rich. And that is the American, has been the universal solvent of America's social crises. Oh no, how do we transcend the limitations of our system to allow for a remediation of injustice? How much does money will it take to make this go away? And real crises explode when there's no money to give away. So what the Reconstruction governments tried to do to fill the gap was build prosperity the same way that the North was in the absence of a civil war to drive economic activity, railroad investment. After the Civil War, created this massive increase in the government's productive capacity and its money supply and its economy. Without a war, that energy had to go somewhere. And because it's a capitalist system dominated by capitalist interests, it went to subsidizing railroad construction, creating a infrastructure, domestic infrastructure of railroad track, not through direct investment, but through subsidy of the private sector. And it was happening all through the West, and it was also in the South. It was supposed to be the engine of prosperity that would obviate all these thorny social questions. What to do about black equality? What to do about the lack of black economic opportunity? Build some railroads. That'll solve all the problems. This will stimulate commerce. It'll bring in northern capital, create economic activity. It didn't do any of that. But what it did do is make some of the speculators very rich, and also a number of the crooked politicians very, very rich. And it created internal networks of commerce that pulled power, economic power and concentration, away from the port cities, which in the antebellum period were the only real concentrations of economic activity in the South, because the plant, the southern plantation system involved getting product not through internal markets, like through canals and through railroads, but by taking it, putting it in the water, getting it out to the ocean, and then sending it to New York or to London. So all the economic activity was in these port cities. Now, the railroad manufacturing is creating internal cities. It's creating a boom in towns and banks and merchant nodes within the South and taking power away from the ports. And in so doing, we see resolved one of the fundamental tensions within Southern society that had existed since the Revolution. And that is that you had a ruling planter class in the South, right? The big landowners, who were the unchallenged political powers in the South, at least in the deep, the places with very extensive plantation agriculture. And then you had underneath them in the cities this much smaller, less powerful, but more economically more dynamic group of merchants and bourgeois, emerging bourgeois, who struggled for influence in state government sort of underneath the boot of this ruling landed elite. The Civil War breaks open and overthrows the landed aristocracy, not completely dispossessing them, but knocking them off of their political perch. And what happens, thanks to these Reconstruction governments, thanks to the direct investment in these real estate railroad speculation company, or this railroad speculation, and the creation of these merchant nodes, is a situation where the big landowners start buying shops, start becoming bankers, start indulging in merchant capitalism, and sort of step down from the plantation veranda to do so. Meanwhile, amongst the grasping class of city folk, some of the more successful merchants start buying land. And this movement resolves this tension and creates this synthesis that is the new landowning merchant ruling class that ends up dominating the South by the turn of the century. This becomes the leader. These become the Bourbon Democrats, who rule over a sort of arrested population of totally subject and deep and politically disempowered black population, and a economically dominated and ideologically mystified poor white population. But everywhere that these new nodes of commerce emerge, they uproot all the existing structures. And in the upcountry, where small white yeoman farmholding and subsistence agriculture was the way of life, the coming of the railroads pulls people away from that and towards wage labor and towards and towards dispossession, a lack of that freedom we were talking about. And the way that the states were doing this is by buying railroad stock, gifting land to railroads, guaranteeing loans, creating a business-friendly environment, which all undermined the support for Republican governments by poor people of both races. And undermining, more than anything, support among poor whites who saw Reconstruction come in. And the main thing that it brought about was higher taxes and that they had to start working instead of living on their farm and living subsistence lifestyle that in their minds was necessary for freedom. Meanwhile, the whites who stayed most loyal to the Republican Party were up in the mountains, where not only had they fought the hardest for the Union during the war, they were mostly untouched by modernization and didn't lose their traditional autonomy. So, and the main thing that the main counterproductive result of all this railroad investment is that it fucking drains the public coffers for all of these new things that they're supposed to be doing, all the education they're supposed to be creating, these infrastructures they're building. And money comes away from that. And that undermines the efficacy of these institutions that are being built by the Republican governments. And the whole time, this is failing to draw in any northern investment because the South is still politically restive. There's no real certainty that Reconstruction governments won't be overthrown. And so northern capital was much happier to invest in what seems to be more stable political situations in the West. And so most of this capital has to be raised locally through through taxes and through more than anything through crop loaning. And then another just poisonous development caused by the railroad is that it's the thing in the South, as much as it was in the North, that created the atmosphere of absolutely pandemic corruption that allowed these railroad interests to essentially buy the government with the government's own money. That's the insane thing. These people all bought all this stuff with government debt and government-backed greenbacks that had been used to win the war, and they had collected them in buckets over the course of the war and were now using them to pay off these politicians, who, especially in the South, were very cheap because their only livelihood was politics. And besides mere brazen bribery, there was insider dealing, where you would give someone stock or give them a heads up on a investment opportunity. And all of these things created these networks of patronage that now came outside of government and involved the private sector in the form of these railroad combinations. And the whole time, the railroads are also ingratiating themselves to the poor, the free black community by sponsoring education and missionary work and offering wage labor away from the plantation, which was something that was very appealing to a lot of, especially young men who didn't want to, they didn't want to work on the plantation because it had these, it had the feel of slavery to it. And the failure here, the botching here, the mistaken effort to invest in the paltry sums that these states had in railroads is a consequence, more than anything, of the lack of capital that existed in the South. There was no money. The economy had been undermined and destroyed. Even the money supply was shrinking because obviously all the Confederate money immediately was worthless. But even greenbacks were being restricted in circulation over the course of this period because they're trying to move to a gold standard because of the reactionary agenda of the capitalist class. And the only way that you could have accommodated the political aspirations of the freed blacks and the political and social aspirations of the poor whites sufficient to create an enduring political coalition that could have held power in the face of the planter class and rulers would have been a mass transition of capital to the South, an internal Marshall Plan. And this didn't happen because, once again, there was no power to seek it. The power at the top of the federal government was held by Republicans who were invested literally in a hard money economy that made necessary capital redistribution within the country impossible. And so what happens is debt comes to be the new instrument of coercion to replacing the old planter or the old labor regimes on the plantation. And it ensnares whites too. The collection of cotton goes from something that was almost entirely carried out by black slaves in the pre-war period to something that 40% of cotton agricultural workers are white by the turn of the century. And every chain in this action is compelled by a lack of capital. It's the debt of the planter who is being loaned the money for his crop that is compelling the sharecropper to go into debt to that planter. At every level, there's a compulsion of debt, and so freed former slaves who don't want to go back to do plantation cotton agriculture are by debt drawn back into it, and poor whites who had before the war been able to live independently are now forced into a wage relationship agriculturally. And this dooms the social project of Reconstruction because it confirms the white supremacist idea that there is a zero-sum racial contest between black and white and that anything that benefits one harms the other because slavery was abolished, blacks were free, and now poor white people are less free. They have less control of their ability to sustain themselves. They have to work for wages instead of work on their own land. And this is not because that's true. It's because the interest of capitalism was the presiding, dominating interest shaping Reconstruction. Once again, you have a thing where the social phenomenon of a political economic structure is blamed for something that it is only a response to. And so, last thing I want to talk about here is something that's really interesting. And it is the way that the different types of plantation agriculture, the different modes of plantation production, respond to this new reality, this new marketized, speculation-based, more internally improved Southern and more financial and more debt-based agricultural system. So there's three main types of plantation agriculture in the South, determined by geography, determined by where things grow best. In the Louisiana Bayou area and in the Gulf, you have sugar. Also in Florida, but the concentrated in Louisiana, you have sugar plantations. Now, sugar planting requires two things: labor specialization, because it's a very complicated process. So there's a bunch of different jobs to do that require different skills to be learned to do them. And also capital, because in order for sugar production to be profitable, sugar processing has to be done on site, which means that sugar houses where the cane is turned into molasses actually have to be built and maintained on the premises. So in this situation, once the coercive power of slavery is gone, and the leverage of the working population is increased in a situation where their specialization gives them leverage, but also where each plantation has already a significant capital value because it's been improved upon. The ruling elite was largely replaced by northern speculators who had the money to fill the gap. They were able to square that problem of a labor population that's going to require more money, more wages than zero, and a higher degree of capital investment with capital of their own. Because it's worth it. Because you've got this fixed infrastructure that has a dollar value on it. And that means that it's worth the investment. And in that place, former slaves were able to negotiate for, if not anything you would want to call a fair wage, certainly a self-sustaining wage. Now, in South Carolina, you have rice cultivation. Rice requires a great degree of labor specialization in the same way that sugar does, but it is capital unintensive. You don't need to have any built-in capacity on a rice plantation. You just pack up the rice and put it on a boat. Now, what that meant was that when the planters were ruined at the end of the war, there was no incentive for anyone to buy the plantations because the value was essentially non-existent. So in these rice areas, the local, the planter elite had to essentially give in to their workforce. And workers were able to dictate, in many cases, completely the terms of their labor, the amount of profit they got, in some cases, actually taking over complete control of the plantation itself to the point where the owners were happy to get anything. But also, what that meant, so you had this like peasant communism develop here in the rice plantations because there's no pressure, there's no capital coming in to reassert a exploitive labor relationship. There's only this poor schmuck hanging on by his fingernails. But as a result of that, though, rice production in the South never really catches back up to its pre-war production. There is economic stagnation. There is no accumulation. There's no capital accumulation, which is necessary in order to compete with other modes of production in other geographic areas. And South Carolina, really, which was where the rice, which is where the rice was grown, was the most radical Reconstruction state in those early years and saw the most successful efforts at ex-slave land ownership and cooperative cultivation, but at a low level of productivity. Because why would you want to work that hard? You're just trying to sustain yourself. You're not trying to build a fucking gold house to live in because you don't have to escape your conscience the way that the fucking slave owners did. You can live simply and happily. Now, in the cotton South, we have something. Cotton production is neither labor intensive nor capital intensive. So there's no capital pressure on ownership to sell like there was with labor, or like there was in the sugar belt. And there's no real pressure from workers for much better conditions. So that meant that for the most part, the cotton planter class got to keep power. Even though some of them were broke for a while, and hilariously, Alexander Stevens and John B. Gordon, the vice president of the Confederacy and a Confederate general, had to endorse patent medicines, like Sarah Palin with the tummy tea on Instagram. Very funny. So so in the Cotton Belt, the planters got to keep control, but they did have to change, obviously, the nature of their relationship with their former slaves because now they had to pay them. They had to compensate them. They were no longer able to directly exploit them on the land through direct coercion. So how were they going to do it? How was this relationship going to be managed? And at first, the slave owners, the ex-slave owners, were happy to use wages, happy to pay in wages, or at least would have preferred to pay in wages. But the former slaves didn't really want wages. They wanted land. And so they, for the most part, pushed for the, to be pushed, ended up pushing their way towards an accommodation that became known as sharecropping, where you would work on a land that was technically owned by the planter, who would loan you seed and capital at the beginning of a growing season, sell it at the end, and give you a portion. Now, this was not something that I think that a lot of slaves would have preferred if they'd been able to pick anything, but in a context where their political power was very attenuated, where there was a failure to really pursue these interests politically, an inability to pursue them politically, sharecropping became the closest, and in the absence of land redistribution, sharecropping became the closest thing to land ownership that ex-slaves could access, even though it meant going into debt. And what you ended up having was not the end of servitude, really, but the replacement of the coercive mechanism of servitude being direct exploitation in the form of an overseer and a whip and lack of bodily autonomy to a compulsion through debt. Now, if you have been a slave, that difference is substantial and worth having and worth pushing for, especially since in these days, the final contours of what that was going to look like were not sure, were not determined, and no one knew for sure. By the, obviously, by 1900, sharecropping becomes a brutal exploitative machinery that annihilates any upward mobility among former slaves. But that was after the redemption, after the reaction and the end of Reconstruction, which, of course, was not anything that anyone could have predicted would have happened and or could have assumed was going to happen when they were fighting just to be able to live on some land and be independent and live not under the gaze of an overseer from the, by some guy on a veranda, but to be in your own land, on your own, even if you don't own it, your own patch with your own home. That was a... That was a step up, and it was a negotiated change in the condition of servitude, basically. But it was not the abolition of the state of servitude itself, and the failure to advance beyond that that plateau was caused by the failure of durable black political power to be articulated in the South, and that all comes down to the failure to redistribute land, because absent land redistribution, there could be no even contest, which is what the North thought they were doing. They thought, we're going to fight to give the former slaves a fair shot at on a playing field. Even absent racial discrimination, which of course cannot be absented, that wouldn't have happened because people were coming into this race literally without a sustenance, which is the only, absent a labor movement, sustenance is the only real leverage you have against the wage relationship and the ability to assert your authority within it, or that or political power. And of course, one flows from the other. And without political power and the ability to go to the land, you will be cheated. You will be denied any kind of fair compensation, so that even if capitalism worked the way that its boosters and the way that these people supporting the Whig dream that was being imposed by the liberal Republicans, even if you believed it, it could work. Under those conditions, by definition, it could not work. And the only thing that could have broken that was land redistribution, which would never have happened absent class power, which did not coalesce. And I think that the interesting thing about this period is the degree of fluidity within these systems, how that like the process from one level of exploitation to another could have moved farther, could have been more dramatic. The arrangement between capital and labor could have settled differently. And I think the entrenchment of land-based black political power in the South could have been a check on this sort of gallop towards total corporate subsumption of the political and economic system that happened during this period in the North. So next week, we'll talk about chapters 9 and 10. And then there's only two more after that. So we got, in 2 weeks, we'll be done with this bad boy. I've had a very good time talking about it. I think it's really interesting. And it's helped me clarify a lot of my thinking about American history, which is good because I've got another couple projects I'm working on that are going to try to consolidate this information into something of like a, you know, a big contours of American history type deal. William Appleman Williams type stuff. Somebody said that we might want to do stuff about the German Revolution in 1918, and I think that's a good idea. If I can find a good one volume on that, I might do that at some point in the future. Oh, yeah. Also, damn, my grandma could make banana pudding. Or what was it? What did Biden say about rice pudding? How his Aunt Gertie made rice pudding. I think that he might, if they let him off the leash enough, it might get funny. He might end up being up there with Trump for funny president. So let's hope so. God, my dad could eat rice pudding. Oh, right. Yes. Thank you for reminding me. Friday, I'm going to game with Chris. We're going to play Anno 1800. Does anyone know that game? So we're going to try to build some sort of 19th century Age of Steam empire. I think that's how it works. So we'll have some fun. We'll talk about my favorite century where all of the old gods died and were replaced by new horrifying mechanical demons. Hopefully we'll fix the choppiness. But it's also like a map game, so it'll be less disorienting anyway. I'm just staring at chat for 5 minutes. That's dumb. I feel like a weirdo. We'll cut this off. All right, folks. Talk to you soon.